you know, how we got there. Hell, you could go back before these parts ever opened up if you wanted the whole story. So, you know, to get to this poetic thinking, this poetic, you know, emphasis that Marty Heidegger has been kind of apparently coming around town and talking about, there's a history to be had, a story that got us there.
Yeah. So Zwicky's going to start the story. Interestingly, and Zwicky does kind of say that, like, oh, I could, you know, even later on into the essay, she will say, like, oh, you know, I could have started with Dave Hume and where he gets his ideas from, but I'm going to start here with Kant, right? With Manny Kant, Manuel Kant, with Dave Hume.
So I don't know, I'll go next. So this is Manny Kant, Immanuel Kant. See, Manny was smarter than most folks. He got to thinking about it, and he realized that if Dave had found what he said he found, then all of science, leastways science as we like to think about it, laws and stuff, scientific laws, was in trouble. If Hume got it right, then science couldn't be certain. That was the problem. So I'm going to pause there really quick for our listeners and basically just say that, you know, Hume famously, we're not going to get super, no one's going to get a super deep dive in this reading, by the way. But, you know, Hume emphasized experience. And obviously experience as the base point of knowledge, and obviously experience comes from inference, but inference can never be certain, right? We can all, there's always the possibility with an inference that things can be different, right? So an example of saying, like, well, you know, I know that the sun is going to rise. Well, how do I tomorrow? How do you know the sun is going to rise tomorrow? Well, because it's risen, you know, every day of my life before then. Well, that's probably true. That's probably the case. We can infer that. But it's possible that in fact, maybe that's not the case, in which case these scientific laws that, you know, that we're so obsessed with, we're so concerned with, may not be as airtight as we were, you know, initially thinking or hoping for. So if Hume got it right, then science couldn't be certain. That was the problem. Why, maybe you'd take this whiskey bottle here, and this time, when you hold her out and let her go, instead of falling, she flies off out of the window or up over your head. You can't prove to yourself before you do it that she's going to do. Yeah, you think all them laws of science, they prove it. But that's just the point. How are you going to know their laws and not just what science types call statistical generalizations? So inferences, sort of summaries of the fact that a heap of things happen the same way. Dave Hume says that that's exactly why they are. And it's only out of habit you thinking she's going to fall on the floor instead of doing something else.
I'll continue on. This is Kant, or this is Manny's reply. But Manny, he's thinking, uh-oh, what if science ain't certain? And it hits him. Wait a minute. If it's just a habit, I think the bottle's going to fall. Well, then that habit can be broken. So he tries to seriously think the bottle's going to do something different. Imagine himself holding it out there, squeezing his eyes right up. He's trying so hard, but he can't do it. And he says, neither can you. Go ahead and try. You get serious with yourself about this. You can't do it no matter what. Well, then, can't be no habit, can it? Still, that old Hume. He was right. It ain't like a truth of logic or a definition. You got to have some experience of the world before it'll hit you. You got to get out there and fool around with whiskey bottles some. So how come you can know it for certain, but it ain't a truth of logic? Well, this was Kant's real red ribbon idea. He says it's like there's these filters in your head, like you got some sort of hardwired circuitry. Everything from the outside's got to come through the filters before it gets to the inside. But the inside is where you is. So everything you see, it's being sort of sorted, pre-shaped like, before it gets to you. you can tell them filters are in there because you've been certain that everything you see is going to be in 3D and it's going to obey the laws of science. Now, them laws of science, they ain't laws exactly, thou shalt not and all. They're more like names for ways stuff tends to hang together. So causality, for instance, that's the sort of thing Manny Cantor called law science. Some stuff causes other stuff. It ain't just whacks of totally similar coincidences. And that's why you don't stop to ask yourself every time you're fixing to haul off and throw your coffee cup at the wall. Now, this time, is it going to head in the direction I throw it? Oh dear, is it going to hit the wall and make a mess? Of course it is. And Manny says you know it. Not because the laws of science are like decrees of God or something. We don't know nothing about God at this point. Nope. Them laws of science, they're like the diagram for the hardwiring. And they ain't out there in the world because that circuitry is in here in your head. But they sure are certain. Ain't nothing going to register in that old noggin of yours but what's been filtered and set up by that hardwire. So that's why you can't break the habit of thinking the whiskey bottle's going to drop. You're hardwired to see the world in causal 3D and letting her go causes her to fall. First of all, I just want to say that it's incredibly fascinating to have Kant's metaphysics or his critique of metaphysics just explained to you in a single paragraph in Southern drawl.
and frankly quite well.
you could genuinely pass off an understanding of Kant with reading this essay. This is actually quite an interesting introduction to, you know, the sort of, you know, modern philosophy, particularly the German side of it as well, because we'll talk about George next, right?
But yeah, going back to that hard wiring, it's, you know, the you know, Kant's Copernican revolution, as we talked about on the show before, and as, you know, that's what's classically said in philosophy, was, well, it would seem that the laws of science, the laws of nature, whatever you want to call it, the things that we're certain about, there's something in the background, and that background is actually us, that means that we're always already going to see things and experience things in a certain way, right? It's our makeup, as Kant calls, you know, the phenomenal world, right? Like there's, we experience the world in a particular way, and there are these laws within that phenomenal world that cannot be broken because that's us. And we can't ever jump outside of our own being and see the world as it is in itself. Instead, we always have to see it in this particular way. So, you know, if the whiskey bottle is always going to fall because, you know, gravity, or how we experience with this thing we call gravity, is a background fundamental functioning of our mental experience of the world.
Absolutely, yes. Essentially, our consciousness is constituted by particular categories, Kant says, and these categories are the preconditions for the possibility of any experience whatsoever, right? He has this really good I think I've mentioned this metaphor before, but it's really illuminating, and it's interesting because it's Kant's own. He doesn't use a lot of metaphors, but he talks about how if we want to think about going outside of and like understanding beyond these categories, you know, seeing beyond 3D or something like that, or without them, you know, it's like imagining a bird flying through the air and feeling the wind resistance. And then the bird, you know, alights on a branch and thinks to itself, man, if there just wasn't all this wind, I would fly so much faster because I wouldn't be flying against anything, you know. But the bird fails to realize that actually the wind constitutes their flight, right? So flight without wind resistance is not possible. In fact, wind resistance constitutes flight, right? So all of these categories that we experience reality through, so like causality being one of them, time, space, et cetera, you know, all the other aesthetic properties, we can't go beyond those or circumvent them because they constitute our experience.
Yeah, like we've talked about on the show before, I was actually going to bring up time or temporality. I don't think we're going to get too technical again with any of the particulars that come up here. But thinking about temporality, the nature of time as a fundamental aspect of the phenomenal world, this human world. You know, I think sometimes people will imagine, well, wouldn't it be great if I was some sort of time traveler, if I lived to like a, you know, some sort of being. I think we talked about this in a recent episode, actually, within the relationship of time, where, you know, if I could, you know, maybe if I could just shoot back and forth through time, if I could just be at any point in time, if I time travel, basically, if that was part of my makeup, wouldn't that be so cool? Well, the issue with that is, one, it's something we simply couldn't ever effectively imagine. It's something we can't do. But also, two, you would also cease to be the kind of being that you are if that was a thing that you suddenly did, right? Like, just like the bird in flight that has the wind resistance. Well, suddenly, if you're the bird that flies somehow without its relationship to the wind, without its relationship to air, well, then you're doing something. This bird is doing something that makes it no longer a bird, right? And it's no longer flying, right? It's doing something else that we can't really imagine, that we can't really categorize or even think about, because it's fundamental to its makeup as to what it is, as the kind of being that it is.
Yeah, and it's important to see why this is a reply to Hume, right? Because Hume wants to say that these are just statistical generalizations, right? They're inferences. Kant replies that actually they're, since they're constitutive of our experience itself, you can't, they can't be seen as like superfluous or compromised, right? Because the whole point for Hume is that this, it wrecks the intelligibility of science, right? Things are no longer on rails. We don't have laws anymore. Whereas this puts intelligibility back into the realm of science because they're constitutive of our experiences.
They're completely constitutive of our experiences. They make up the fabric of our very being.
Exactly. And so therefore, talking about causality must somehow metaphysically like grasp or touch the matter at heart. It's not just guesses or inferences.
Then Hegel comes along. Now, old George was one long-winded, souvenir-sided show host. History, he thought, you had to do all of history over again before you could say how we do. How he finally gets his chickens lined up, and he says to Kant, "Well, you know, Manny, this hardwiring idea of yours, it's pretty good. I like it. Gonna get me one too. But where you think the circuitry diagram comes from? You start with the things from Descartes. I think, therefore, I am. You say the I am bit. It's just totally obvious. And you build your case from there. But hell, Manny, you just stole the circuitry diagram from Aristotle without thinking where he got it from or if it was ever even what you actually needed. And if we're really hardwired, then I am bits also got to be obvious because of the hardwiring, not as something separate that twigs you from the facts. The hardwiring's there, if you see what I mean. Well, maybe you don't. I admit it's kind of tricky. What I mean is, you say there's stuff out there in it comes in through the filters, gets shaped by the circuitry. But listen, Manny, how can we actually know that? You say unfiltered stuff's coming through the filters causes us to have experiences of filtered stuff. No input, no output, right? But ain't cause one of the filters? So even saying that, you're thinking filtered? No way we can ever have any idea whatsoever of anything that ain't been filtered. But if it's been filtered, it's in here and not out there.
Yeah, this is interesting. I want to also comment as well, because I think that Zwicky is aware that the stuff before you know, it kind of relatively goes over okay, but then very consciously it's like, if you see what I mean, well, maybe you don't. You know, Hegel is tricky, and it's easy to recognize that Hegel is tricky. But
for our listeners, if our listeners aren't familiar with Hegel, Hegel is notoriously difficult. The notion of history as a sort of hermeneutic circle, a circle of interpretation that's going on, wherein, you know, even these, you know, Manny Kant says there's these filters, they're fundamental, but even those filters are filtered by the spaces in which someone like Manny Kant is operating within, right? They don't sort of, he didn't just sort of arise them out of nowhere. They're part of a larger sort of twirling and whirling of knowledge, of dialogue, of dialectic, as Hegel would say, that, you know, you've now interpreted and made into this system, but that system is always itself a kind of evolving social historical event or series of events that's kind of an intention with itself.
The filters, if they were there, they got there somehow. They must have, like, developed in some way, and consciousness, you know, it's developed. And it could develop in a different way too. The thing too with that George saying to Manny is that basically, look, you have this idea of stuff out there and stuff in here, and that's all fine and good, but if really all we can experience is, you know, the phenomenal stuff, what's in here, those filters themselves are going to be in here, right? I mean, it's one thing to think that, okay, well, when I try to imagine all possible experiences of a thing in space, it has to happen in three dimensions. Okay, well, the filter itself is all evinced by what's being filtered, right? You don't actually ever have any kind of experience of what's unfiltered. So it's just... It's not that there are two things and you know one and you don't know the other. It's just all inside, right? Which is why he's talking about no way we can ever have any idea whatsoever of anything that ain't been filtered. But if it's been filtered, it's in here, not out there, right? So it's not that there's anything out there being filtered at all. It's all in here, which is, we'll get into, you know, how that develops. So I'll continue. So George says to Manny, so number one, there can't really be no in here, and this is gonna get really cool. There can't really be no in here and out there. It's all got to be the same thing, and that thing is thought, capital T thought. And number two, if you think hard about why you went ahead and just reached for your Aristotle, or why Aristotle come up with the categories you borrow for your diagram, you'll realize it's all in the language you speak, whatever that happens to be. So thought is the only stuff there is, and even more important, this is the totally important thing, Manny, thought itself is made of language. It's made of language.
Yeah, so that's sort of what I was kind of hinting at with the last component, is there's this, like, you know, language comes to the fro, language of capital L, just like you were saying, thought, capital thought, it's all thought, it's all language. Yeah, but emphasizing that it's not just so much language, like, in the dictionary, it's the fact that there's we exist, you know, whatever we are is these phenomenal filtering beings. You know, there's this a shared conscious experience that is historical, that itself is kind of like this giant linguistic filter, that is for itself always kind of circling back and reinterpreting and rebringing itself back up and digging deeper and, like I said, kind of building this tension. And that, you know, you can't really just stop with just, okay, I figured out, like, man, you can't figure out these categories, here they are, I've got all the pieces, here's the science, it's the hard science, we're at the bedrock, we've got it all figured out. because it's by the virtue of our very nature of our linguistic dialectic, we're always in a kind of movement of interpretation.
Yeah, absolutely, right? And I mean, that interpretation is always one that's linguistic itself, which is kind of it's where thought and language kind of connect for Hegel at this point, right? Because if we're always sort of interpreting things, it's always going to be in language. That's how we make sense of past events. We have to use our reason and reflect on them in our memory and whatnot. We have to use our minds for that. The other thing, too, is that Kant does, I can't attest to this, but it seems like Hegel is critiquing Kant's just sort of careless borrowing of Aristotle, and that the categories originally from Aristotle are very consciously like linguistic, right? He is categorizing language use and whatnot. But Kant is mistaking language use and the categories that divide up the possibilities of language use for the possibilities of all experiences whatsoever. And the intelligibility is not necessarily that these are constitutive of all experiences, but that it's language that is intelligible, right? Because language is the medium of our interpretations and of our understanding. And so when you borrow language, that's when you get intelligibility. And that's sort of the mistake that Hegel is pointing at with Kant, right? He doesn't really solve Hume's problem because he's not actually reaching out to reality and the rails that you'd have to put on for reality. He's just touching, it's just touching language, and it's all language.
Now, I want to rein in a minute so we can see where we've got to. We start with this worry about the nature of scientific laws, gotta figure out why we just can't change our minds about them, and we end up here. Language is all there is. Now come on, you can get your head in a whirlwind, all these fancy dress ideas dancing and spooning, and you know what else, with each other, but if the place it gets you is there ain't no chairs and tables, ain't no paper you're reading on, ain't no TMX or bees or CO2, ain't nothing out there but what we didn't say it first, because there ain't no out there, no begin with, and what it's only, and it is only what our pappies and our grandpappies said for all his history's creation. Well, I say, whoa, Nelly. I say you're willing to go along with that. You ain't never gone more than half an hour with an empty belly. You ain't never seen nobody have a heart attack in front of you or been caught out on a prairie in a thunderstorm. Now, I'm not saying our minds don't sometimes bend things out of shape, and I'm not saying some of them don't look different if you're from Lapland City or New Jersey. But I am saying if you let either multiculturalism or modern metaphysics convince ya, you or you and your gang are the author of the world, you stopped paying attention to the brain in your Wheaties some time ago. Zwicky's kind of pointing out the obvious level of kind of confusion and whirlwind that we sort of get ourselves in with Kant and Hegel, and the sort of like this tension between these two. This seems awfully confusing, and I like how he goes on to say, "Whoa, Nelly, you ain't never seen nobody have a heart attack in front of you or being caught out in a prairie in a thunderstorm." What ends up happening is we end up being kind of removed from the more personal side of personal experience, and we end up focusing deeply on laws of thought that, you know, that make any sort of thinking or experience possible, or laws of history that make any sort of language or dialogue possible, and we end up thinking that this is kind of the bedrock of all stuff, when in fact, you know, this starts to seem to be very alien from what it's like to be, in a kind of phenomenological sense, to be a person, to be out there in the world, you know, seeing the thunderstorm, seeing your loved one having a heart attack, you know, having these experiences which are deeply personal, and which, you know, these sorts of more deeply metaphysical, scientific, ostensibly scientific laws seem to kind of not be able to take account for as things that we actually live with, the sort of lived experience of being a human being, of being there in the world.
Yeah, of, to put it in a word, of ineffable experiences, experiences for which words are inadequate to communicate, or which don't do justice to our experiences in a certain way, right? We've ended up by kind of cornering ourselves and having to exclude what are some not just ineffable experiences, you know, things like immediate sudden tragedies or awe-inspiring experiences, but even just, you know, like chairs and tables, just that there's stuff there that is independent of our saying it, right? Yeah. So we've got
the kind of classic philosophical ridiculousness of being like, you know, is there a chair? Is there a table? Is it real? And it's like, okay, well, all the stuff that Manny Kant and Hegel and people and things are doing might be interesting, but it also seems that the farther we go with this, the farther removed we are from this more, you know, as you said, ineffable, personal, almost artistic and aesthetic experience of the world, of what it's actually like to be us, right? You know, instead of, you know, there might be something about me that, you know, obviously I live in time in some sort of way, or I'm temporal or whatever, but the category of temporality is not something that I'm actually thinking about or concerned with or is affecting me in the way that I actually live out my life and make decisions as a human being.
Thank you for listening. You've been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show, and please join us for the next half where we introduce Marty Heidegger into the story.
You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
CJSF is 90.1 FM, broadcasting from the heights of Burnaby Mountain.
This is Bird Note. No human dreams of relaxing on the shores of Novaya Zemlya. It's an isolated group of islands in the Arctic Ocean, north of Russia, that's best known as a Soviet testing site for nuclear weapons. Yet a growing flock of pink-footed geese have begun to make this militarized zone their summer home. Pink-footed geese spend the winter in the British Isles and Western Europe. The UK population migrates to Iceland and Greenland, but the rest breed exclusively on the Norwegian island of Svalbard. Or at least they used to. In 2018 and 19, researchers attached GPS trackers to 21 pink-footed geese in Finland. To their surprise, half of them turned up on the Russian islands, roughly 600 miles east of Svalbard. This region was once too cold for the geese to raise young. But climate change and increased competition for food may have made Novaya Zemlya a compelling alternative. Researchers suspect, though, that these geese didn't stumble upon this new migration route on their own. Pink-footed geese sometimes mingle with taiga bean geese, a species that visits Novaya Zemlya when it's time to molt each spring. It's possible that the pink-footed geese followed their lead, which could prove to be a rare example of cultural knowledge being transmitted between species. Birds of a feather, indeed. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.